beginning of wisdom, but also in failure, that's the mother of liberty, so to say. So we may entertain some comments and questions on failure, liberty, success, democracy, and again, the welfare state as before, because nothing was quite exhausted.
Yeah.
My question will deal with what you said at the beginning of your presentation, the fact that success and failures are two concepts belonging to modern world. Belong to the modern world.
Yes.
Do not belong to traditional society. So, I mean, don't you think that welfare state, as Alberto was proposing right now, is sort of an institution trying, which was born by the fear of failure? I mean, if it's true that success and failures belong to the modern world, isn't the welfare state an answer to the fear of failure? The fact that failure is something which cannot be allowed. We have to cancel it, to avoid it, and so something that the political power, modern political power, the state, is the institutionalization of the fear of failure.
I think that's exactly right, and I think that if you develop that thought, and it's a very interesting thought, then socialism is the attempt to eliminate failure from the world, partly because success in socialist and in the among the ideas of socialists and those who believe in social justice of an extreme kind is always the result of bad of causes. It never is a moral response to the world, which in fact most things that we experience are. It is something that simply is in the genes or is in bad upbringing or some aspect of society which can be changed. And I think that's the crucial point. I date that kind of thinking back to the Enlightenment in the 18th century, which is, in my view, the point at which people said to themselves, look at this marvelous power we have over nature, and we're beginning to develop more and more understanding of nature. What about society? Surely, I mean, human beings being rational creatures, we must be able to change society just as we have changed nature. So I think it's a technological illusion that is basically behind this kind of thinking, yeah.
Can you please elaborate a little bit on the aspect of the dynamic, maybe especially in the last 200 years, of shifting the burden of failure? And not only in politics, but also in business, like with the use of limited corporations instead of the old personal enterprise where the entrepreneur was giving all his personal wealth as warranty for his business.
Do you mean that the individual took personal responsibility and would lose his money, whereas in a corporate organization, people can be foolish and the consequences are not directly financial. Is that?
Yes.
I think there's no doubt that the limited liability company was a very important part of the development of capitalism. But the problem with every solution is that it has a problem concealed underneath it. And the problem concealed there, if I've understood your question properly, is what economists call the agency problem. You can never be sure that the people who are running a corporation will do what they ought to be doing in the interests of the shareholders. In fact, one of the great forms of management theory in the last 10 or 20 years has been to emphasize shareholder value and, you know, the profits that come from shareholders as being the central duty of chief executive officers. I mean, it's a dream, but it's a popular dream.
And that's your last remark is clear and right. In fact, some people argue that when the emphasis shifted from doing the right to protecting the shareholders' value, you know, we create some of the seeds of the recent problems.
Yes.
But my question to you, I'm sure you will say yes to this, is whether the attempt to eliminate individual failure leads to community failure.
Certainly, yes. I think there's no doubt about that. The word community is the one we need to focus on here. You see, the modern state is an association of individuals and individualists, that is, people who are, amongst other things, and that's the important qualifications, they're, amongst other things, they are pursuing self-interest. Now, there is a school of thought, an anti-capitalist school of thought, which suddenly raises up the words greed and fear as being the terrible motives that lie behind people pursuing self-interest. And this is, this is, I think, nonsense. By and large, other things being equal, if a worker is offered a higher wage or a lower wage, he perfectly rationally takes the higher wage if other things are all equal. The Madoff case might, I suppose, be certainly an example of imprudence because people didn't look into the way in which the whole operation worked and the risks involved in it. But by and large, if you're investing your money, you want the highest returns, if you possibly can. Makes perfectly rational sense. The notion that this is greed is idiotic. Now, there is, I think, a moral collapse in the way in which firms operate. I mean, in Britain, the LIBOR, the fraudulent manipulation of interest rates, in the known as the LIBOR case, was undoubtedly fraudulent, and there are wrong things that people do. But I come back to this word community. You see, the dream of socialism is that we should live in a true community. And a true community is one in which the individuals are assumed to respond to the needs of others, so that you become, in a way, an instrument of the common good, the communal good. Whereas an association is a set of people whose only real reason for being together is that they all obey and respect the same set of laws. They believe in the pursuit of they obey the rule. Or, in fact, obedience is not, of course, at issue. They simply conform to the rules. If they want to get something, they don't murder people or steal or do things of that sort. So the thing that you are pointing to, I think, is the aspiration that a lot of people have in the name of justice to transform our present associative social relations into a true community. Now, association and community in these cases are both ideal models. I mean, the real world we live in is a mixture of both. And we are, you know, both self-interested and also patriotic, you know, both kinds of emotion are operating, and it's all very complicated, like everything else.
I don't know whether it is allowed the minister in there to be trumpeter when we...
Upon the payment of a fine.
Yes. And the creative destruction. But in the business schools, they teach you should kill your most successful product. And I remember Andy Grove, the founder and CEO of Intel, saying, only the paranoid survive.
Franco was pointing out to me earlier that Kevin Dowd's suggestion for the pension problem should not be called the Pakistani solution, because Pakistan has cultural problems in that sort of respect. Yes, Intel, you see, it was, I think, Gurdjieff, wasn't it, who was one of the great occultist influences in Western life, coming from Russia, who thought that each day you should burn the money that you had acquired the day before, because every day should be a kind of new start. And I take it that the point of this rather lunatic idea is that you should go on innovating all the time and not stick with the innovation you have already made. But I may have misunderstood the question there. Have I?
But we shall earn the money that we have earned today listening to you and to these conferences.
Yes. Yes, I don't... It is, as you say, totally paranoid, and you'd be mad to follow it.
Accounts.
I'd like to ask you, at which point, according to you, a society starts to refuse progress for fearing failure, such as starting to dream of a socialist state, or just starts to like enlarge its welfare state? Because I think this is, like, as you said, fear of failure. At which point does a society start to fear it, or a society or a whole civilization, such as, I don't know, the Roman Empire, or also we see that, for example, in Protestant societies, there is more market orientation because there is a religious reason behind the will of challenging yourself.
Yes, if I've understood that rightly, you're sort of getting at what I think is the ideal kind of society. And of course, the answer is that there probably isn't one. I mean, we are people of a specific kind, and we could only live in societies that have a certain degree of freedom. Freedom is, I think, the essence of the societies that Europe has created, but maybe losing as time goes on. I mean, the basic fundamental principle is simply that no matter what kind of society you live in, some people will lead perfectly happy and fulfilled lives. There's almost nothing that human beings cannot or will not respond to. On the other hand, they do have very strong preferences. And my belief that Western civilization is unique, that no other civilization was on the way to getting close to it, and that it is very it's better in many ways, if not, it's not perfect, but it's better in many ways than other civilizations. It's not just what I think. I mean, people are swimming seas and drowning in boats and climbing over walls to get in. So, you know, I think they may be stupid, but nonetheless, that's what they want to do. And this is one of the great central facts of our time, which isn't taken on board by those bizarre people often in universities who think we live in an inegalitarian, oppressive, what have you, society.
One aspect that I would like to dwell on more is that in modern society there is an inherent tension.
In what society?
In modern society, yes. There is an inherent tension between success and failure.
Yes.
Obviously, if we want to strive as we want, as we have to, for social order, we need to sanction failure. I think the etymology of failure is from fault, from sin. So I think you have to make sure that people do the right things. However, as you rightly said, it's only with modernity and with freedom that you see failure as a value.
Yeah.
And without failure, we don't have innovation, we don't have risk taking, we don't have decision making. So I think there is a tension there, and there is something in which it's very difficult to strike an agreement. Now, the question to you is practically where we really come to terms with this tension is in failure law.
Failure?
Law.
Yes.
How we deal with the failures in the legal system. Because it's there when you practically come to terms with this. And in your view, what are the societies that perform better in trying to have failure law that, on the one hand, preserves social order, on the other hand, and avoidable? And on the other side, encourages risk-taking, encourages innovation, and
I don't know what other societies have a better failure law. Partly because I don't know that other civilizations have a legal system of the same kind that we do, which is highly defined, which develops with judges, often in some parts of Europe with juries, and so on. There is there are constantly changing laws responding to failure. There is in America something I don't know much about called Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And this appears to be an almost acceptable form of bankruptcy, where bankruptcy is sometimes thought to be a tool of corporate development. Now, I don't understand this, but I think I'm inclined to take the view that has been being discussed over the last 2 days, that too big to fail is ridiculous. Let them fail. You know, if firms have done foolish things, and even if circumstances have turned against them, that's life. And if you try and block that by governmental action, then the long-term consequences are probably going to be very bad. So I can't give you an answer to the question to your precise question, but I think you're on the right track in thinking that there are now in our legal system ways of mitigating failure which perhaps have unfortunate consequences, or will have in the long run.
I wish to have your opinion about meritocracy, because most people live very often defend meritocracy because there is kind of individualism in this logic, the idea that people are rewarded for their effort. At the same time, in the political philosophy, now meritocracy implies a very, very negative approach toward capitalism, because you remember Machiavelli, the role of fortuna.
Yes.
And in the capitalist society, you need to be a lucky guy, in fact. It's important, your skills, your activity, obviously, but if you're lucky, it's better. So a free society is not a meritocratic society. Do you agree with it?
Meritocratic is a word I don't think I've fully understood. Meritocratic is the rule of people with merit, I suppose. And it is becoming one of the themes of social thought at the moment that in our highly educated societies where people go off to universities, around 20 to 30% of the people are now educated. They're in the professions, in journalism, in politics, they may be novelists. They are, as it were, the educated pen pushers, the people with computers and all that technology. Furthermore, they mix with each other, they marry each other, their children are also meritocratic because the children have good backgrounds and read books and do all the good things, so that we are now developing a new form of class division between the skilled on the one hand and the unskilled on the other. Now, in Britain, and forgive me for using the parochial example, the question of social mobility has become a major question. In the past, there were always people who rose in the world and succeeded from rather poor backgrounds. The economist Peter Bauer, whom some of you may have read once wrote a pamphlet for the Center for Policy Studies called Class on the Brain, because he was fed up with the English saying we live in a class divided society, which I agree with him. You know, coming from abroad, I don't think class is any more important in England than it is in other countries. But Bauer's pamphlet consisted of pointing to people who'd come from nowhere and risen to quite high positions. And there is a famous book published towards the end of the 19th century called Self-Help, which consists of nothing else but biographies of these remarkable people who went off to night school and eventually invented some gadgets for railways and became rich and successful. Now, however, there is a complaint that not enough people are rising up and going to universities. In fact, there are large numbers who are, and there is a strong bit of evidence to the effect that the difference is really IQ rather than background, that the ones who don't get into universities simply fail IQ tests, and whether you take them seriously or not, they are of some significance. But the government has nationalized social mobility so that although it has ruined the schools by preventing meritocratic practices in the schools, it now says universities must take students from schools even if they don't have the best examination results, if they come from a rather poor background. So what you have is the interesting paradox of the government wanting to help people to become richer, more cultivated, and so on. And of course, the moment they start earning the money that results from this, they're going to be taxed and part of the greedy middle classes who are not concerned enough about the poor. So we have one of the many strange paradoxes of political life.
Just to add, I agree completely with your assessment that now the rich have married the rich, the educated are married, the educated Harvard graduate are married, Oxford graduate, and so forth. And this is creating also where people live, especially in the United States.
Indeed.
You can judge people's education and income simply by the area where they live. But there is another element that helps in that direction, which has worried me a lot, you know, in some of my recent writing, has been the question of complexity in the laws. Complexity in the tax system, complexity in the regulatory system. This allows the people with money to hire the best lawyers, the best accountants, and so forth, and get a certain results. and resources which are not available to the normal middle class that does not have that power. You know, go to the best doctors. You know, there is all this kind of, well, maybe the doctor is more complicated, but clearly the tax law, the complexity of the law, opens this possibility. You know, that, do you see this as a problem?
I think it's part of a whole complex of problems that have arisen in the last 10 years and which particularly attach to the bonus culture, which has grown up in banking and then in the civil service and in local government, where people get paid extra money for doing what is their duty. And it seems to me that that combination of people being paid for doing their duty, it's a perverse form of incentivization, I think. But it is what corrupts the world. At the moment, it's happening on a relatively small scale, but it's getting to be a larger scale. And I think it's very corrupt indeed. It happens at lower levels where sometimes young children are paid, children paid to stay on at school from 16 to 18, which on any rational calculation, if they have any talent, would be a sensible thing to do, but they get money for it. People suffering from sexually transmitted diseases or from obesity are paid to consult their doctors. These are relatively small cases, and I have challenged a colleague who is a big wig in the social service industry about this, saying how corrupt I thought it was, to which he replied with words that stick in my mind, "But it works." Now, if something works, this is, I think, a sort of collapse into a kind of corrupt pragmatism, and that's one of the ways in which current life is becoming more corrupt. You see, I think corruption is one of the big questions of our civilization at our time. Members of Parliament in Britain who began exploiting the expenses system would often, when charged with their lack of integrity, say, "But we didn't break any rules." Now, this is part of, I think, the collapse of the moral world in our current society. They think firstly, that to be good is to be altruistic or benevolent towards vulnerable people, but they forget that that rules are different, that integrity, that courage, that prudence, that there are other virtues which are also very important as part of the moral life, and I think they don't really reflect enough on this kind of thing. So these are all cases. I mean, I'm beginning to move into my soapbox aspect, and I must not do that. But I think that corruption is a very important aspect of the modern world.
Is there any other comment?
I don't want to monopolize, but this is a fascinating discussion. And so I'll take advantage. You know, you go back to the question that in the business school now, they tell students that you should maximize the rate of return to shareholders rather than follow ethical principles. But coming back to what you just said, you know, we've moved into a society where we worry about observing rules and not principles. This can be very different. The rules are made, the more rules there are, but we can abandon completely the principle. In the tax avoidance,
yes,
is a classic case.
Yes.
As long as you follow the rules, you don't go to jail. jail, even though the intention is to avoid taxes.
Yes.
You see this as a dilemma, that we're creating too many rules, we are abandoning the principle, that disappeared from guiding us, you know.
I think that's absolutely central. I mean, I like the distinction you made between rules and principles, which is absolutely crucial. We have been learning in the last few days, actually not for the first time, that tax law is now thousands of pages long.
80,000 in the US.
That now takes a bit of reading, that 80,000 pages. So, you know, we're not going to get very far by trying to do it ourselves. You're perfectly right. I mean, what made me slightly nervous about your question was that the people who employ tax accountants for tax evasion purposes are, I think, very rich. They're not the your average middle class. I immediately thought myself, I employ an accountant, but that's because I'm bored by the business of, you know, putting my tax returns together. So, you know, it is a difficult problem. And I think, you see, the great reason for bringing the state into social and indeed moral life from at least the beginning of the 20th century was always, we now live in a more complex society. And the government is to some extent responding to that complexity, but far more, it is creating that complexity. Indeed, it is hard not to think that the creation of complex, incomprehensible rules is a bureaucratic technique for increasing power. And it's true, for example, of the European Union, which is relatively recent in its legislative role, but again, for one thing, it's a great acquis. It's a set of rules and laws which everybody joining must accede to. And it is becoming way beyond anything that an ordinary person could respond to.
If they may take advantage of discretionary power, it is clearly one of the subjects, one of the theme of your book. We want to paraphrase Lord Acton. The problem is that power corrupts, that democratic power corrupts democratically, which means all the reform. The essence of our society is that when we talk about corruption, we are not just talking about decision makers in Lazio. It's just what it happens. But we're talking basically about everybody. I mean, the real corrupted dramatis personae are voters. I mean, everybody is getting a chunk of redistributed money. It's fiscal churning, it's welfare state. I mean, the system is conceived in a way that everybody thinks it is convenient to stay in rather than trying to opt out because it's getting just a little bit, some bonds. And of course, this brings us to that question you don't like people asking, which is what to do. How can you even conceive to change the pillars of a system whose genius is giving something to everybody, to any and each of the citizens, so that they think it is actually convenient for them to keep the system in place in spite of the effects of the growth and so on and so forth.
Yes, I suppose my answer to the question, what ought we to do about it, is merely Hayek's answer, which didn't work terribly well for him, and that is to say ideas have power and we must spread this idea. But Hayek, in towards the end of his life, was, I think, disappointed and puzzled above all by the fact that the arguments for a free society And there's really no alternative. Even the Occupy lot in America don't have an alternative to capitalism except constant talk about regulation. Obviously, it has to, it has to be some sort of regulation has to be recognized. But Hayek's problem was, why did they not understand the wisdom of his views? And in the end, he was drifting towards a kind of evolutionary view, namely that we are programmed because of the genes of millions of years of development towards wanting to live in small, tight, almost familial communities, and that this was what lay behind the passion for socialism. I don't think it's a particularly plausible view. What I think is that the dream of a just society is something that is a bit like Father Christmas. It will never go away, or at least Father Christmas may possibly go away. But the idea of a society that is just, in the sense that everybody gets what they need, is a strange dream which people think must be possible for us. I mean, governments have so much power, there is so much clever technology, education is a way of changing people's attitudes. There are no doubt people who are mentally have mental problems and who perhaps are disabled in one way or another, but we can always do something about that. The point in my view is that we are the only society that was ever created on the basis of freedom. Not because we deliberately said let's institutionalize freedom, it's simply that as the Middle Ages went on and out of the sort of people that we were and out of Christianity and out of the varieties of the feudal system, all sorts of liberties grew up. The demand that the king should consult with the grandees of the kingdom, and you get Magna Carta, and universities in which people start trying to make sense out of the mysteries of Christian doctrine. Bit by bit, here we have a set of liberties, and by the beginning of the modern world, people are beginning to think of this as a central thing called liberty, to which we are attached. If, on the other hand, you get a kind of technological version of this, as with Marx, which teaches that some large class of people are oppressed and they must rise up and create a free society, we now know, I think, with absolute certainty, insofar as you get certainty about these things, that that is the way to create a slave society. So the only way in which people can get freedom is by living it bit by bit, and sometimes, no doubt, having to defend it against the bidding of kings or other powers. By contrast, every other civilization, I think, is based upon justice, which we don't have. We have civil justice, which comes from below. Other civilizations have a kind of justice which, for the most part, comes from above, is comprehensive, deals with everything in life, the Sharia or the caste system or whatever else it is, tribal views and so on. And from the inside, all of these systems are believed to be how every human being should live. From the outside, of course, most of them look ridiculous. In fact, I think they all look ridiculous from our standards. But that's the contrast, I think, between justice in some sense that we yearn in some sort of way to achieve and the freedom that we actually live.
Any other comment? Question?
Got it.
take a few seconds.
I think in the end that's the definition of failure as success, that we have failed for the sake of our freedom, and that we are free and therefore we aren't a controlled society. Therefore we do mess up sometimes, and our leaders mess up, or elected and those in business. There are ways of dying for freedom that aren't simply on a battlefield.
There are
ways of dying for freedom.
Yes.
That aren't on the battlefield. Because you live in a free society, maybe somebody owns a gun, or somebody drives a car into it. In a very controlled society, you might not have had a license. And I think this, the crisis that the world is going through now, the Western world, is one of the prices of our freedom, that these things can happen. Nobody's been shot for it. And maybe that's a good thing.
I think you're undoubtedly right that they do happen, and that, in fact, you simply do have to accept the fact that you cannot create perfection out of human life. I suppose that's involved in the Christian belief in everybody being a miserable sinner and so on, is it not? I mean, we're all, or in the Hayekian version, we're all ignorant. We'd better recognize the things we do not know. As I think Professor Tansey said this morning, we don't understand lags in our economies. And I thought that was a very interesting remark. But the things we do not understand are, of course, multiple. And I suppose they're all failures, and attempts to compensate for those failures I'm not going to be successful.
Comments? Questions? One? Two? Three, therefore we shall leave it. Yeah, one. Two. Then we shall really thank Ken Milo for this wonderful and